Welcome to episode 79 of the Cycling Europe podcast. My name is Andrew Sykes and welcome to Coniston in the Lake District. For the first time, the Cycle Touring Festival, which up until now has always been held in Clitheroe in Lancashire, has decided to move up to Coniston in the Lake District. And I'm looking out across a sea of tents, and it's the gathering place for about 200 people listening to and hopefully being inspired by tales of people heading off on their bikes near and far. But first, I need a coffee.
Welcome to the Cycle Touring Festival again. I'm afraid we couldn't arrange the weather, so it's quite wet, but hopefully the rest of the weekend won't be quite as bad as it was last night. And we've got a really exciting programme planned, as you will have seen from the timetable, and it's really good to see everybody here in person again.
Before we take you on our trips through Cuba and Mexico, we want to say a little bit about how we got into going cycling in seemingly less hospitable
with these amazing creatures, seeing them underwater and studying them, learning all about them so that we can protect them as a species. We got to do lots of cool stuff with science equipment underwater.
Work really well. Other things likely to go wrong: broken racks, bottle cages, things like that. Off the time.
Yeah. And did you have any problems en route?
It's a trust machine.
Courage was their armour as they fought at Fidel's side with Che Guevara.
It was quite dusty. And I happened to put in one of the many things I probably didn't need was my mask. And this was, of course, before mask wearing was a thing.
Those were just a few of the sounds that I recorded at the recent Cycle Touring Festival. I'm now back home in Yorkshire. My original plan was to actually record some interviews with various people who were speaking at the festival, but then it dawned upon me that actually a lot of the people speaking had previously appeared on the podcast anyway. So, for example, Mark Wedgwood, he's the chap who cycled every OS map in numerical order. He appeared on the podcast last year. Libby Bowles, she's appeared, talking about sustainability. Neil Whedon, he's appeared. Caroline Burrows, the poet, she's appeared a couple of times, I think. Paul Cheese, he's the chap who cycles around recording sounds, human, natural, unnatural sounds, and putting them together in a soundscape, in a piece of music. It's phenomenal the amount of equipment he has on his bike. But I met him up in Scotland a few years ago and recorded a chat with him. There was also Martin Howe. Now, Martin actually contributed to the podcast that I made before I went to the Outer Hebrides. So he was talking about that, talking about cycling the Hebridean way. At the festival, I didn't actually realise it was him, but he was talking about cycling around the British coast, and hopefully he's going to appear on an upcoming podcast about Shetland and Orkney. So hopefully that might be even be the next one. And Rob Ainsley, of course, the man who provides the music to this podcast, he was talking about cycling 1970s style, and he kind of adopted various methods and practices that were popular in the 1970s, and he spoke quite comically about that. He has appeared on the podcast many times, and I'm hoping to get him back on at some point to talk about his experiences of cycling 1970s style in 2024. So in the end, I just thought, perhaps there's not a podcast here, but it was a fascinating event and hopefully it will continue in the future. So my original plan had to be changed. When I got home, in my email box had arrived a monologue from a chap called James Thomas. Now, James lives over in India, But he contacted me last year asking if he could contribute to the podcast to talk about his experiences of cycling in Europe as well as cycling other places around the world. And I said, yeah, yeah, sure, why don't you record a monologue? And it was only after hearing what he'd recorded that I thought, ah, yes, that could be a possible theme for this particular podcast. So without further ado, I'm going to hand you over to James Thomas, who is going to talk to you for 10, 15 minutes about his own experiences of cycling in Europe and elsewhere.
I'm James from the UK, and I now live in the tropics, in South India, in the north of Goa, which is where I've been for the last 6 years, spending summer in the high mountains or in Europe and the UK, but predominantly living here very close to the Arabian Sea on the beach in a small fishing village. And it's stunning. I'm just here. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning. The sun's really high in the sky. It's hot, it's humid. The monsoon will start in a couple of weeks, so it's actually the hottest it ever really gets, you know. Until the rains come, it's very sticky, but it's a great place to be. It's super relaxed, super easy vibe. Yeah, it suits me pretty well. And living on the subcontinent does give me access to the high mountains with particular ease. So I tend to ski in Kashmir, backcountry skiing up there, in Gulmarg, which is fantastic, highly recommended. And Central Asia is just a stone's throw away as well. So I also went to Kyrgyzstan this winter for a ski up in Shimbalak, just outside of Almaty, which I highly recommend. Very good resort. And the cycling and hiking here in the Indian Himalayas is hard to beat. It's rustic, it's raw, and it's rough. But it's great, you know, for that reason. It's not bike packing because you're still following an organised infrastructure of a road or whatnot, but there's a great tradition in India of the pilgrim, you know, the Baba, the seeker, walking from place to place, holy site to holy site. And particularly in the north, this is something that you'll see actively if you find yourself in the country, you know, you'll see these folks walking around. So with that infrastructure historically in place, there are places to stay, food and lodging is available quite easily. And so these very remote places become super easy to reach and get into. So just by way of invitation, this winter, this autumn, I'll be taking a group, maybe 8 cyclists, up to the high mountains of India to cycle the Manali to Leh Highway. And don't let the word highway confuse. It's a rough path that stretches from a pretty comprehensive town, which is Manali, up into the very high mountains over a couple of very high peaks, 4,000 and 5,000 meter passes in the Rotang Pass, Kilar, Tanglang Lar, 5,300 meters. So pretty big climbs, and that all happens in a space of 450 kilometers on the way to Leh, which is also a fantastic, beautiful place, and which is almost Tibetan in culture and tradition. So if that's of interest, I'll be doing that this autumn with a group of 8. So if anyone listening wants to join in on that, go to the website and take a look. You'd be welcome to join us. So that's kind of where I am. And all this kind of fondness for the Indian Himalaya and this part of the world, the subcontinent, came to me as a result of having cycled across Europe, believe it or not. And that's really what I wanted to speak about today, sort of to tie in with Andrew's fantastic new book, Le Grand Tour, and just to speak about some of the possibilities and things that cycling in Europe could lead to as a bicycle touring enthusiast, as I am. So over the years, I've cycled in more than 40 countries. More than half of those have been in Europe, which is the first thing I would say about cycling in Europe. It's infinitely accessible, particularly from Europe itself or the UK. It's just right there on our doorstep. You can take a sailboat, you can travel by rail. You know, there's really every reason to be there this summer and do something fantastic with a bicycle. So it's easy to get to. It's super diverse. You know, I love Europe. The culture, the people, the food. Every day you can be in a different country and with it, its own quirk and peculiarity around how they serve the beer or how they make the cheese or how they bake a loaf of bread and how they sit around the square and talk about things. And the culture is really still in Europe, very rich and very interesting. But it's also super familiar in a good way, you know, because we're all aware of Europe. We're such close neighbours with it. And the continent offers so much possibility. I know for this particular ride, which I'm speaking about, which was sort of my gateway, if you like, my pathway into cycling in a big way, before I did my self-supported solo journeys, I cycled with my best friend, Adrian. And our idea was to raise money for charity, for Recycle, the Bikes to Africa people. And so we set a target to send a container full of bikes over over to Africa, which we did. And in order to sort of funnel the money into that charity and raise money, we took off on our very own grand tour. And the target was 20 countries in 100 days. And we did it. We did 22 countries in the end over the course of 100 days. Europe is one of the few places in the world where you could do that, you know. I think in one afternoon we managed to get to 4 countries. We're going back a few years now. This is 2011, so my memory's a little bit hazy. But I've got to say, it's very accessible. It's super enjoyable. And that journey for us began really with a sail crossing from Hull to Rotterdam. We went over to the Netherlands, and then we found our way to the Black Forest and the source of the Danube. And from there, we followed that river, sometimes in and out of the path itself, the Eurovalley 6, to go into the mountains, to get into the villages, to get into some other distractions and diversions. But essentially, we followed the Danube all the way to the Black Sea before cutting down into Greece, doing a lap of Thasos Island, and then coming back up the Dalmatian coast. Within that framework, we covered every eventuality and kind of magic and experience you can have on a bicycle, you know. The thing that landed for me most strongly was, you know, people are good and the world is safe. Those were the sentiments that I sort of took away from that journey. And it was that journey itself that gave me the confidence some years later, once I'd saved the money and got stuff together, to cycle to Vietnam and back, you know, to cross the whole continent as a landmass as far as I could and come back with it. So, and that also introduced me to India, which is where I live now. So these bike rides, these grand tours, they lead to bigger and better things, massive, epic, life-changing things. So do read Andrew's book and do inspire yourself to make a journey in Europe this summer. There's really no better place to do it when the sun is shining and the beer is cold and the food is so delicious. So do jump into that. That's my recommendation. But before I wrap up, one of the things that I remember most fondly of this trip, and there were so many memories, but as we reached Albania, and at the time it was Lonely Planet's most popular destination, it was the coolest place on the planet, I think, according to Lonely Planet magazine. And we would just happen to put it, you know, put a dot on a map and said, we'll go there, because we needed to go to 20 countries. So it wasn't like we premeditated it. We just needed to get our numbers up, you know. We crossed, and everywhere we went, we said we're going to Albania. People say, ah, it's so dangerous. There'll be gypsies in the mountains and murderers and all this kind of stuff. And we were like, all right, we'll take our chances, see how it is. And the closer we got, the more excitable people got. And finally, we crossed into Albania, and very dramatically over a massive range of hills, and coasted down into this valley. Loads of people washing cars and hose pipes squirting up into the air because it had rained and there was a big river nearby. And it was amazing. Just a real spectacle, you know, these hose pipes shooting into the sky and sort of rainbow crystals falling down in the refracted light. It was amazing. And the first place we pulled up in Albania was just like a roadside cafe, I guess. It looked like it just opened. It was almost like a cyber cafe, very basic place with a computer and a load of teenagers. Well, we stopped. This guy was kind of waving frantically from the side of the road with both arms that we stopped. So we did. We got to talking like you usually do, and he's like, oh, what are you doing? Where are you going? What's the thing? What are you doing here, you know? And we sat with him, and this chap was called Selly Tabaku, and he got into his story, and he was one of the first people in the country to speak English as a professor, and had lived this amazing life, visited the UK a bunch of times, commentated the football in the 90s, international football between Albania and England, wildly suggested that we stay the night, and we thought, of course, we'll stay. We were 40, 50 days into our trip by then, so we were comfortable with these kind of invitations and this kind of scenario. It was really our thing. So we said, yeah, of course we'll stay. And they found a wild hen and cooked it up, and we had supper, and then they decided to name the cafe after us, so they called it the Hungry Cyclist, which was brilliant. And we left one of our cycling shirts to put on the wall and all that kind of stuff. And as it happened, we'd started our journey from Nottinghamshire, Croxton Abbey, which is where Lord Byron's interned. And Sally Tabaku was actually a member of the Byronist Society, and he'd actually been to the Abbey where we'd started our journey. And this connection, this sort of synchronicity of this meeting and this overlap of our lives, this place in Nottinghamshire, just, we all were totally spellbound by it. It was amazing just to be in such a weird and remote place, having this wild conversation with this chap who'd lived such an interesting life in Albania, this shared experience of having been to this same place, and importantly where we began our journey some weeks earlier. It just brought the whole thing together as a really beautiful moment on that journey. And that's very typical, I think, of when you step out into the world with a beautiful idea and a smile and a good attitude, great things happen. And this is, for me, one of my favourite memories of that trip. So Sally Tabaku, RIP, what a chap he was. And very interesting guy, wonderful chap. Actually, when we sat down to meet, before he even introduced himself, and we just pulled up the chairs, and he said, "You've come all this way here to Albania, and now you're going to get a test. I'm going to give you a test." And we're like, "Okay, what's happening now?" And we're sitting on this veranda, this balcony, this cafe, and it overlooks this huge expanse of valley where he's been walking all afternoon, this mountain range. He just says, "My heart is not here. It's in the mountains chasing wild deer." And just stares the both of us really intensely into the eyes. And I look at Adrian, Adrian looks at me, and we're like, okay, we just have to take a guess at this. And I think, you know what, Sally, I think that's Burns, isn't it? That's Robert Burns. And he's almost falls off his chair, and he's like, of course it is. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And from that moment, we're firm friends, and the whole thing is a magical, a wonderful moment. And yeah, the mountains are calling. So do explore Europe, and do make the most of this summer with Andrew's book in your pannier. Explore those wonderful, mystical, magical corners of Europe and the continent. Get some cheese and a baguette, put it in your pocket, and take off on your bike. So that's it from me. And yeah, once again, thanks, Andrew, for hosting this monologue. And yeah, if any of this idea to cycle in the Indian Himalayas resonates, do drop me a message by email, which is reallybigbikeride @gmail.com, through the website, which is reallybigbikeride.com, or on the socials, which is realbigbikeride on Instagram and Facebook. Love to connect with fellow cyclists and learn more about your adventures and share some stories around the world by two wheels. So great. Once again, thanks, Andrew. Best of luck with the book this summer, and look forward to reading a copy very soon. Bye, everyone. I'll see you again. Bye for now.
Thank you for that, James. That was excellent. Thank you. Really interesting. It can't be easy in a place like India finding a nice, quiet corner to sit and record something like that. But actually, I think the sounds, most of them, actually add to what he was saying rather than detracting from it. Well, perhaps apart from the banging noise at some point. But anyway, he was talking about Albania there, and it got me reminiscing about my own experiences of cycling through Albania back in 2013. So I actually went back to the book that I wrote, Along the Med, and I reread the chapter where I talk about crossing the border from Greece into Albania. I think it's the same border that he took when he was there. And what you're about to hear is my experiences of doing just that. It's the chapter of the book when I leave Greece and I enter into Albania. Part 2, Albania. Thursday the 11th of July 2013. Cycling day 9. Ionina to Saranda. 107 kilometres. I woke up on that final morning in Greece to the most magnificent sight. As I pulled open the flap of the tent, which I had purposefully erected to point in the direction of the lake and the mountains beyond, a most wonderful vista of morning tranquillity was revealed. The grass was bright green and slightly damp in the dew. The foliage of the trees was equally vibrant, and a mist hung over the pristine lake that was gently lapping against the shore just a few metres away from where I was lying. I could hear the calls and oars of early morning rowers on the lake. They were presumably making the most of the opportunity to practice during the coolest part of the day. And in the far distance were the occasional squawks of wide-winged predatory birds. A few kilometres away, the mountains rose out of the water on the other side of the lake, but with most of their detail masked by the mist, apart from the fine line that distinguished their dull green and brown slopes from the cloudless blue sky. The whole of the scene was drenched in bright morning sunlight. Beautiful. Just beautiful. Had I not promised myself that I would be ticking off the first of my 10 countries later that day, I would have been perfectly content to sit and watch Lake Pamvotida all day. I think that was what most of my neighbours were spending a few days doing, and I could certainly see the attraction. There are strong arguments that travel broadens the mind, but there are also pretty persuasive ones that dictate that from time to time you should just stop and stare. Here in Ioannina, I'd found good evidence for doing just that. I moved from being horizontal in the tent to a vertical position on the grass and stretched in a way that only campers and some wild animals will appreciate. The tent itself, just like the grass, was very damp, so I unpegged it from the ground and dragged it over to a nearby strip of concrete that was already bone dry. I also released Reggie from his overnight position, tethered to a tree, wheeled him onto the concrete, crouched low on the floor, and took a photograph of him silhouetted against the sun. He had rarely looked better. His mechanicals were also in fine form, having survived the roads of Greece without any issues whatsoever. The mishap with the Presta valve back at Athens Airport was beginning to be forgotten. Leaving Reggie to guard the drying tent, I packed everything else away and wandered over to the reception area to see if they sold anything for breakfast. They did, but it was limited to processed croissants in cellophane packaging. Not that this prevented me from buying a couple and munching through them as I returned to complete the process of loading everything back onto Reggie for the cycle towards the Albanian border. Everything was done at slow speed, as it was a delight to work in the warmth of the morning sun, and I was in no particular rush. Eventually, I was ready to depart and push the bike back towards the area in front of the chalet-like building at the entrance. In the middle of the car park was a large tree, around which had been built a low wall. Sitting on the wall was a cyclist. His lycra shirt contained most of the colours of the rainbow, and on his head he was wearing a baseball cap turned so that it faced backwards. I nodded in his direction and exchanged greetings with him. "Are you going far?" I inquired. It was a bit of a silly question, as next to him was not only his bicycle, but also a trailer piled high with equipment. "That's a bit of a silly question," he would have been perfectly entitled to reply, but fortunately didn't. "I'm going east in the direction of Thessalonica," he did reply, and I detected an accent. "Are you French?" "Yes, my name is Jean-François, and I'm from Brest." It turned out that Jean-François was not just cycling across Greece, but cycling around the whole of Europe, an adventure that was going to last some 7 months and take him most of the continent's countries. He had set off from western France in April and was following a route that would guide him along most of the edges of the continent, both the sea borders and the land borders. He was about 50 years old and had taken a break from being a cycle courier in his hometown in Brittany. It was quite some feat he was attempting, and made my own little jaunt across the continent resemble Les Vacances de Monsieur Hulot. If Ed Cox and his cycle to Brisbane had been in the Premier League of long-distance cycling, Jean-François Lestrade was certainly leading the championship. We chatted about our respective routes, but again, as when I'd exchanged experiences with Ed earlier in the week, Jean-François wasn't able to offer advice about Albania, for he too had taken the ferry from Brindisi in Italy to Greece. I was so desperate for some recent first-hand knowledge of cycling through the country that still remained a mystery to me. I would simply have to find out for myself later that day. Jean-François was just as keen as I was on keeping tracks of where he was cycling, but instead of investing in some lightweight computer equipment, I had an iPhone and a mini iPad, both of which could easily fit in the pockets of one of the small panniers, he had brought with him his relatively bulky laptop computer. I was beginning to see why he needed the trailer that was attached to the back of his bike. Indeed, the comparison between my efforts to travel light and his less successful ones was something that Jean-François later commented upon his own blog. He insisted upon showing me the exact route that he had taken and the myriad of statistics which his Strava GPS track was able to furnish him with. It is truly amazing to consider how much data is now available to your average cyclist as he or she goes about their daily commute, or in the case of Jean-François and myself, our continental journeys. Until relatively recently, this information was the preserve of the military or very well-financed sporting teams in money-drenched Formula One. Now it's cheaply accessible to almost anyone who wants it. It's just as amazing how little interest it is possible to have in someone else's statistics. I nodded and smiled without taking in much of what Jean-François was telling me. Elevation, moving time, calories, cadence, cuddly toy. I activated my own iPhone GPS tracking app at the gates of the campsite with a promise to myself to use the data only sparingly in conversation should an opportunity arise. I consulted my paper map and estimated that it would be a cycle of around 60 kilometres to a place called Kalpaki, at which point I would turn left and cycle another 30 kilometres to the border with Albania. From the border, it would be a gentle ride back down to the coast at Saranda, where I would be looking for a hotel, having long since given up much hope of finding many, if any, campsites in Albania. The final few hours of cycling in Greece were spectacular as I climbed higher into the mountains. I was travelling through extremely remote and wonderfully verdant countryside. Even the campsite in Ioannina was busy compared to the isolation I was feeling as I moved closer and closer to country number two on the list. I paused at a bakery that I found in a town about halfway between Ioannina and Kalpaki and fell into conversation of sorts with a man who turned out to be Albanian. He spoke no English and I spoke no Albanian or Greek. He was fluent in both. But we somehow managed to communicate the fact that he had lived in Greece for 25 years and that I now needed to turn left towards the border with Albania. No, no, I insisted, while pointing straight ahead. No, no, he retorted, while pointing down a road branching off to the left. I smiled and thanked him for his useless insistence that I turn left. I knew that I needed to arrive in Kalpaki before considering turning off the main road. That's what my paper map said, although it wasn't something I could confirm via an electronic map, as there was no 3G signal available to me in the remote mountainous area. But something wasn't right. There was something about the road itself which, as I cycled out of town, degenerated somewhat. It was still very much a proper road, and there were no issues with cycling along it, but it had suddenly been downgraded significantly. In addition, the traffic that there was along the road had more or less stopped, and most cars and lorries were turning along the road indicated by my Albanian friend. I asked a passing pedestrian the direction to Kalpaki by simply saying the name of the town and proffering my hand in the two possible directions. "Here, Kalpaki," she said, while pointing to the floor. What? I was in Kalpaki already? Surely not. There are times when, for some unknown reason, you take on board a fact and never question its validity. Crime is rising. No, it isn't. GCSEs are easier than O-levels. No, they aren't. Kalpaki is 60 kilometres from Ioannina. No, it isn't. All morning in my mind, I'd been cycling towards a town that was 60 kilometres away, when in fact, it was a mere 30 kilometres away. I must have seen signs along the road that told me that, or at least hinted at that, but I'd clearly chosen to ignore them. I was indeed standing in Kalpaki, and the Albanian had indeed been correct. Why did I have the temerity to think otherwise? An Albanian who had lived for the past 25 years in Greece would surely be someone who knew the direction to the border. I doubled back and, rather sheepishly, turned along the road towards the border, the road that the Albanian chap had told me I should be following. He was still standing outside the bakery, and I couldn't help but glance towards him. He smiled and waved. I've no idea what the Albanian word for idiot is, but I'm sure he was thinking it. In those last couple of hours of cycling in Greece, my mind wandered between the fear of entering the unknown and the occasional distractions that I found along the way. Reminders of fighting from the early 1940s with the word Oxy still visible in big letters on the side of one of the valleys. A modern fighter jet parked by the side of the road on an embankment with its long pointy nose, complete with even longer spear-like radio antenna, jutting out above the heads of any passing road users. And the idyllic Lake Zaravina, which, according to the information boards along its shore, had been puzzling travellers for centuries. It read as follows. Holland, a physicist and a doctor that passed by the lake just before 1820, reported flammable gas released through a hole in the ground. A passerby reported dark stones that smelled of petroleum or tar and that burned when placed in fire. Had I stopped reading there, a shiver may have passed along my spine, but I continued and was informed that, in the eyes of modern scientists, the stuff about flaming gas and burning stones was complete tosh, although it took a couple of paragraphs to explain why. Finally, after a welcome few kilometres of freewheeling downhill, I climbed a kilometre or so to the border crossing. From a distance, the small cluster of modern buildings looked like a shopping centre, and to a certain extent, that was what they were, as there were opportunities to be deprived of your last euros or first leki, the Albanian currency, on either side of the border. But above all this was a proper border crossing, the kind of which is increasingly rare in our Schengenized continent. I'd visited the town of Schengen during my 2010 cycle to southern Italy, a place where Luxembourg melts into France and Germany almost seamlessly. But here, in one of the furthest reaches of the Schengen area, there were no such informalities. My passport was checked first by the Greeks, then, after a short cycle through no man's land, by the Albanians. All this will no doubt be swept away when, as it inevitably will, Albania joins the European Union. But for the time being, I gloried in the rare opportunity to feel as though I was a proper international traveller. Greece had now ended and Albania had started. A large white sign proclaimed, "Welcome to Albania," in Albanian. and just past the border buildings themselves was a semicircle of what appeared to be closed shops and money exchange outfits. To the right was a large metal communications tower. There were no problems with 3G signal here, and a fenced-off car park with vehicles that had seen better days. Many of those, I guessed, had been in the 1970s. I cycled a short distance away from the border to a point where the road curved to my left, and I was able to look down upon a long valley with a wide plain at its bottom. I pulled on the brakes and dismounted to take in the view and to work out my bearings. The first thing that I noticed was how abruptly the landscape itself had changed. Gone were the valleys of deeply wooded slopes. This land had been stripped bare of almost anything that could be used for fuel on a fire, or so it seemed. It was possible to follow the line of the border behind me, as it was the point where the trees were no longer standing. I aligned my map of Greece with the line of the border running north to south, and it too reflected the fact that vegetation was abundant to the east, it was shaded green, but there was very little to the west where, apart from a few isolated patches of green, the map was white. Not that my map would continue to be of much use for much longer. I was about to hit the edge of the paper, and having forgotten to purchase a map of Albania before I left home, I was now reliant upon the far less detailed black and white maps contained within the Brat Guide to Albania that I did have with me. The journey from the border into the valley before me, over the mountain on the other side, and then down towards the coast at Saranda, would be about 30 kilometres. I remounted Reggie and took the plunge, freewheeling around the curve in the road and towards the flat valley bottom. I would eventually become accustomed to experiencing regular changes in the style of the road paraphernalia around me, but this was the first of those changes. Different signs, different fonts, different markings on the road. Within a few minutes I was cycling along the flat, wondering at which point to turn, and once again head out of the valley. There were a few candidates for routes, but as I followed them with my eyes up the bare hill opposite me, all but one petered out and disappeared. The one that didn't was first signposted Jorgukat, and then, much to my relief, to Saranda. That wasn't too difficult. I stopped to buy some water in Jorgukat itself. It was not so much a town as a collection of buildings spread along the road that by this point was a few tens of metres above the valley bottom. Lots of the buildings appeared to be abandoned, but one most certainly hadn't. It was a brand new betting shop, but, reasoning that it wasn't the best place to buy water, I ventured a little further along the road to a shop that was set back from the road. The woman who served me was a delight, asking where I was going and indicating with her angled lower arm that it would be a bit of a climb. She wasn't kidding. It was a steep crawl of 300 metres over a distance of just 5 kilometres, with the final couple of kilometres along a bendless road straight to the top of the hill. I paused occasionally to take in the views, and they were just reward for my toil. I was in urgent need of food, and just over the crown of the hill I found my oasis in the form of a petrol station. I was the only customer around, and the two likely lads who were running the place initially looked towards me with suspicion, and I reciprocated. Both sported bright yellow t-shirts that I assumed passed for a uniform of sorts, and both looked and sounded as though they'd been knocking back beer since lunchtime. They were also chain-smoking, but it didn't seem appropriate to point out the potential risks of doing so in their current environment. "Hi, do you speak English? You are English or American?" "I'm English. Do you have any food?" "Why you come here? Albania is shit country. No money, no jobs. Everyone leave to work in England, Germany. Money, money, drugs," one of them said cryptically. These two were clearly not on message when it came to welcoming foreigners to their country. Despite the harsh words towards their own country, they were in fact affable company for the few minutes that I spent at the petrol station eating some more of the pre-packaged croissants that I'd enjoyed earlier in the day at the campsite in Ioannina. I'd only been their second customer of the day, although the wad of euro notes that one of them pulled from his pocket in order to give me change implied they weren't on the bread line just yet. From there, it was a long glide down towards the sea at Saranda. An attraction called, in English, Blue Eye, was being regularly advertised as I descended from the petrol station. 15 kilometres, 10 kilometres, 8 kilometres. So when it came to the point where I was invited to turn right to visit the Blue Eye, it seemed too good an opportunity to turn down. Advertising does work. It was somewhere from the main road, or rather it seemed that way as I meandered past the potholes in the road towards a large lake. At the edge of the water, a better quality road started, and under a rusting overhead sign saying, "Welcome to Blue Eye," there was a man wearing what looked like an army uniform. He was in charge of the barrier across the road, and was also responsible for collecting the money. I had no lekki on me, just euros, but he opened the barrier anyway and let me through without charging. I still had no idea what I was about to visit. The road once again deteriorated to the point of being comically potholed, but after a few minutes I arrived at a cluster of buildings in the woods. There was a bar, a restaurant, and quite a few families milling around. There was even a large coach parked up outside. How did that manage to negotiate the route I'd just taken? A man indicated that I should leave the bike by the side of one of the buildings, and when I went to find my lock, he wagged his finger, indicating that it wouldn't be necessary. Warily, I did what he said, and walked further along the path into the deeply wooded area, leaving Reggie at the mercies of any passing thief. It was a pretty little spot with a fast-flowing river and a couple of bridges over the water, but after 5 minutes or so of following the arrows, I was back where I started, still none the wiser as to exactly what the Blue Eye was. For the remainder of the afternoon, I kept my eyes wide open, taking in as much of this new country as I could, and resisted any temptation to deviate from the path I'd chosen. At times, I passed sights that surprised me. A large shantytown on the outskirts of Saranda, for example, but many others that reassured me that this was just as much part of 21st century Europe after all. The enormous signs advertising Vodafone being the prime example. I'd expected Saranda to be a quiet fishing port, but what I found was a large seaside resort that wouldn't have been out of place had I been travelling through any other Mediterranean country. I found a bar and ordered a beer, opened up a browser on my phone, and with no connection issues whatsoever, within a few minutes I'd booked myself a room at the 3-star Hotel Palma. It was all a far cry from the kind of Albania that I thought I was about to visit only a few hours previously, and as I sat on the balcony of the hotel, overlooking the crescent of shoreline in front of me, complete with high-rise apartments and hotels, a pristine beach, a smart outdoor swimming pool, and yet another large advertising hoarding for Vodafone, I was a bit confused. Albania wasn't meant to be like this. So those were my experiences of travelling through Albania back in 2013, or rather, the first day when I arrived in Albania. I continued cycling north and basically followed the coast from Sarande up to Vlorë and then eventually to Tirana, the capital. I stayed all the time in either hostels or hotels. Spent 2 nights in Tirana, and that was a real surprise. I really liked Tirana. It was a very interesting place to visit. And then after having had the day off in Tirana, I continued my journey north. And then the following day, I arrived in Montenegro. You can read all the details about how I got on if you get hold of a copy of my second book, Along the Med. But that was more than 10 years ago. And James, he was last in Albania in 2015. So I think what we do need is a modern-day perspective of what it's like to cycle in Albania in 2024. So I got in contact with Explore. Explore is a travel company, and they organise walking tours and cycling tours in many places around the globe, including Albania. And I spoke to a woman called Laura, and she put me in contact with somebody in Albania called Dritan called Gini. Hope I've pronounced his name correctly. And he is the tour guide for Explore's cycle tours in Albania. So earlier today, I had a chat with him online, and I started by asking him to introduce himself.
My name is Dritan Uysay, or Dritan, to make it easy. I'm a guide since 8 years. I do mainly alpine. I'm leading groups in the mountains mostly, but since I'm a cyclist myself more, I like lots of sports. I'm doing kayaking and basketball. I used to play since high school. I was in amateur teams, let's say. And because of the passion for sports and outdoors, I started even doing cycling tours in Albania, which mainly operate in the south of the country.
Where do you live in Albania?
So I'm capital based. I was born in Tirana in 94. It's what we call the democracy generation, those born after the communist dictatorship, which ended in 91. And I lived here till about 10, around 2004, late 2004. My family left to Turkey. My dad was working for the government of Albania at this time. So I grew up abroad for a couple of years in Turkey and later on in Bulgaria. And late 17, I came back to Tirana. And after studying history, one thing comes to another, sports, culture, they all mix together. And I'm because of communicative skills, I believe, I got into tourism and tour guiding.
I was in Albania in 2013. And the other person in this podcast, James, I think he was last there in 2015. Have things changed a lot in the last 10 years?
Things have changed completely, in fact. From 2013, I would say especially, there's been a change of governments because political side obviously has its effect on the terrain, on the places that if you're cycling through Albania, you'll go and visit and see differences. But in 2014, Albania was accepted to become an official candidate to join European Union. This means it translates into more funds coming into the country related to many things, education, health, employment, and infrastructure, at least throughout the main roads or the main major cities, let's say, of the country.
And has there been an improvement in the cycling facilities? I remember being there in 2013, and there were very few bicycle lanes. There were very few routes that I could follow. I was trying to follow the Eurovelo 8, but I don't think I saw any signs for the Eurovelo 8. So I did take the roads, and the quality of the roads was was not good. Has that improved?
So when it comes to, let's say, marking of the trails, in fact, because of technology, it's probably easier for us just to go through the GPS. Now, when it comes to cycling lanes, dedicated cycling lanes, if you're touring around Albania, you don't have that yet. So let's say in the main roads, you'll just have to take, we call it the main interurban roads. But because everything is so densely concentrated in Tirana, it means that the rest of the country is more laid back, let's say, a bit more relaxed. Therefore, cycling in these interurban roads will always be, in fact, a pleasure, because also the drivers, the car drivers, they're more laid back, as that's the most fitting word I can think of. Everyone is very relaxed in the outskirts of the country. So if you're doing a cross-country tour like Velo 8, Eurovelo 8, I think it's getting better with every year to come.
The route that you follow for Explore, it's a loop that goes from Tirana all the way back to Tirana. So you take in the coast of Albania, going through places like Sarande and the Lagora Pass, which I remember passing through myself. But you also cycle in the east of the country, and that is very, very mountainous, I think.
Right, you're correct. It's quite mountainous in the east. In fact, if you look at a topographic map, let's say, you will find out that the east of the country is the continental side of Albania is very mountainous. And then the west side of the country, which is facing the sea, the Adriatic and the Ionian coast, only the Adriatic, in fact, because in the Ionian, which is the deepest sea in the whole Mediterranean, it's all mountains dropping down to the sea. But the Adriatic shores, they are usually flat. So it's easier to cycle on the western parts of Albania than it is on the eastern parts of Albania. But once you get to Lake Ohrid, let's say, that's already 700 meters of elevation. So you reach some kind of plateau, and there already you've made it through the worst. However, with tourist groups, keep in mind, we're trying to make these tours not just as a challenge or a full-on two-week touring holiday, let's say, but it's a more relaxed, and we're trying to, maybe in a shorter amount of time, trying to fit in as much as we can. So with exploring in particular, since we're taking the case, we're first driving to this plateau by Lake Ohrid at 700 meters. And from there, we start the cycle with the aim of completing about 420 kilometers by the end of 6 days of cycling, which is some challenging distance, in fact. It's not as easy, even though it's just 420 kilometers, because it's mountains everywhere. Every meter counts.
I was reading some of the reviews on the Explore website, and some people definitely have made comments about the scenery, stunning scenery, the variety of the landscape, eye-opening. Which places in Albania do you think that the people that you guide, which are their favorite bits?
Yes, that's a very good question. In fact, if you ask me, I can never choose a favorite bit. But because I love the whole country, it's so diverse from east to west, from north to south, even though it's just a similar size to Belgium. For people that I've taken on these trips, the more pristine, the quieter places, the more in the outback, in the countryside, those are the most preferred places. So let's say in eastern Albania, once you start from Lake Ohrid, that's already impressive enough, the oldest lake, the deepest lake of Europe. So that already is stunning scenery, you can imagine. And then once you leave Lake Ohrid and you're going south to Korça, and then further south to Ersek, there is a town called Ersek. And this is very deep regions in southeastern Albania. And from Tirana, there used to be like 10 hours of driving by car 20 years ago. Today, you can access these places in 3 hours driving, which makes it so much easier to be there and still enjoy the pristine nature that Albania has to offer.
I remember the hills being extremely steep. I can't imagine that's changed in the last 10 years.
So the hills remain there. The mountains remain there, you know. And for me personally, that's the beauty of Albania, that you've got these uphills, but then you'll be rewarded with different views, with a nice downhill. Yes, there will be some steep bits, but in southern Albania, you'll never get more than 13% of steepness, and that's for very short distances. So most of the steepness will be on an average of 6 to 7%. So if you can do 6% for 1 hour cycling, then keep in mind that the rest will be very enjoyable for sure.
The groups that you escort, I would imagine probably all of the groups use hotels and hostels. But for independent travellers, people on bicycles who, for example, are following the Eurovelo 8 from Greece in the direction of Croatia and beyond, what are the camping options? I seem to remember finding it quite difficult to find campsites, so I didn't. I just stayed in hotels instead.
Thing is, if you look into the graphics, let's say, of how cycling tourism has developed here in Albania, I would say it's just getting there under the radar. It was nowhere near. And you would only see these solo travelers by bike, and me being a cyclist myself, I remember very often seeing loads of them, but this was 10 years ago, right? You've been here more than 10 years ago, and I can imagine it was very difficult for you. The Albania you've seen more than 10 years ago, I have to tell you, it's not the same anymore because of these European investments in order to integrate Albania into European Union community. So today you can imagine hostels, campsites, agrotourism farms, anything you could think of. There is like in every other 40 kilometers, 50 kilometers. So if you're doing a short day or a longer day, it doesn't matter because you can go to a village and there you will find a agrotourism or campsite, as we might say.
What about the other aspects of traveling, things like the food? Is the food in Albania good?
So I believe your listeners, they have been to the Mediterranean before, but if they've never been, they should know that Mediterranean food is some of the most known food in the world, the best food in the world, and anything can grow in Albania. You can imagine it's a country located between Italy and Greece. So if you think of Italian food and Greek food, I personally, being raised for some time of my life in Turkey, I personally really like Turkish food. But we also have that influence because Albania was under Ottoman rule for 500 years. And with our neighbors, Italy and Greece, we have 1 million Albanian in each of these countries. So you can imagine 1 million Albanian in Italy, of course, they will bring back what they learned from there. 1 million Albanian in Greece, they will bring back what they learned from there. And if you are more into gastronomy, let's say, not just local food, you will also find that today in Albania.
Is there a problem with wild dogs? If you go to Greece, for example, you can have issues with dogs which are wild. Is that an issue in Albania as well?
I've never had the issue cycling with wild dogs in Albania. I would never think of such. Usually, you don't see wild dogs in Albanian mountains running off with nothing to do. Usually, it's shepherd dogs that you get to see. And shepherd dogs, as long as you leave the sheep alone, they will not try to defend the sheep. So that's my experience. And what I hear from Greece and from Romania more, I hear the dogs in Romania can be quite aggressive. Speaking of countries I know nearby here in the Balkans. But here in Albania, I've never had any such issue. And I've never heard of anything like it.
The drivers in the urban areas, can that be an issue for cycling?
What I worry most about is, first of all, just Tirana. Because Tirana is completely different from the rest of Albania. This is key important to know when you're coming to this country. Tirana has about 30% of Albania's population. More than 30%. So imagine the rest of the country, like there's no one out there. So urban areas, yes, in Tirana, I won't say I've never had accidents. I've had some minor accidents before because drivers can be rough and stressed and there's a lot of ego on the roads sometimes. So for Tirana, yes, I would say be cautious and always expect the unexpected. This is like a key rule for me. Because it's so crowded, like people are, imagine like Tokyo crossways, something like that. It's getting just now, just this last 10 years, I've never seen anything like it. It's like I'm a newcomer in my hometown. But the rest of Albania, very easygoing, very relaxed. They will honk at you, but that doesn't mean to F off. That means to just saying hi to you and they want to cheer at you. That's why they honk on the car. So sometimes foreigners can be a culture shock.
When I spoke to Laura, who works for Explore, to get in contact with you, she told me that the bookings for people on the trips that you organise, on the trips that you lead, have significantly increased in 2024. She said they were up by 40%. And she also said that people are beginning to see Albania as the new Croatia, because it's a country that is now opening up more to tourism. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. I mean, how was it? Like, Greece became the next Italy or something, then Croatia became the next Greece, and Montenegro became the next Croatia, and Albania is right there with Montenegro, I believe. Both two countries aspiring to join European Union. And for young Brits especially, I mean, me, myself, I really like British culture. I like the British people. I get along very well. I'm trying to learn the British tongue, not RP, but maybe some jargon from the language, because I like the idioms and the phrases that they use. So yes, for Britain, Albania has become a hotspot right now. It's not just walkers, trekkers. It's not just cyclists. It can be just families who want to come here to enjoy their vacation. It can be young ones who want to attend. There's British festivals going on. And I know how Brits love their music. So you've got those coming to Albania. So in any town you'll see in Tirana, especially Tirana, but in any town of Albania during the season, summer, you'll see like every weekend events happening, musical events happening. So yeah, it's definitely getting there.
Thank you for agreeing to speak.
It was a big pleasure talking to you, Andrew. Yes, absolutely.
So that's it for episode 79 of the Cycling Europe podcast. Thank you to James. Thank you to Dritan. Thank you to Laura for setting up that conversation with Dritan. When I started making this podcast, I really had no idea what direction it would go in, but I'm glad that it did end up going in the direction of Albania, because I have to say, since starting to make these podcasts all those years ago, I've always wanted to make a podcast about Albania, because I think it's one of the really undiscovered gems of Europe. So, yeah, top tip, get yourself to Albania on your bike. Go and follow the Eurovelo 8 like I did back in 2013 from Greece all the way to Spain and Portugal. And I'm sure you'll have a fantastic time. So thank you to all those people who've contributed. Thank you to you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to get in contact, then you can do that by visiting cyclingeurope.org/contact. And if you'd like to support the podcast, then you can do that by visiting cyclingeurope.org/support. I will be back for episode 80 of the podcast very soon, hopefully, now that the book has been published. I can hopefully spend a bit more time making these podcasts, so hopefully it shouldn't be too long before episode 80 is available to download and listen to. So thank you for listening, and happy cycling.